This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about a conference to help families who might want to adopt one of the many African-American children in McLean County currently in foster care.
The whole topic of adoption really isn't receiving the attention that it did, say, 10, 20 years ago.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with Doris Houston of the ISU Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. Get previews of the new seasons of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival and Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, thanks to Laura Kennedy and Judy Valente. And find out how you can benefit pollinators in your own backyard during an edition of GLT's Grow. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's June 15th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. About 40% of all children in foster care in McLean County are African American, yet in 2016 they accounted for only about 26% of the children adopted and placed into permanent homes. A conference tomorrow at the ISU Bone Student Center called The Heart and Soul of Adoption aims to change that by helping families better understand the adoption process, the unique experience of adoptive families and children, and the services available to them. Doris Houston is a professor of social work and director of the ISU Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Studies. She tells GLT's Judy Valente that many African-American children today are raised by relatives in informal arrangements, but that formal adoptions traditionally have not been a part of African-American culture. It has to do with U.S. racial history.
Before the Civil Rights era, many African-American families, or I should say most, were not even allowed to be served by your average adoption agency. So if we go back in history from the time African-Americans came to this country during slavery and post-slavery, there were many times families were separated and extended family, friends, neighbors would raise children. So that tradition has continued. African-American families made their own arrangements informally to care for children.
Why would African-Americans not be allowed to participate in adoption services, in formal services that existed?
That's a part of our history. There were a number of areas and services that families of color were kept out of, similar to things like school segregation. So it was just another form of segregation during a period of time that in our history we probably don't like to think of, but it is a reality.
The situation today in McLean County pretty much parallels the national level, and that is that African Americans are a small percentage of the population here in McLean County, and yet they comprise almost half the number of children in foster care. Why is that?
There are a number of structural factors within our society that may create the overrepresentation of children in foster care. So, for example, there is some evidence that when a child is born, if that child is born to a low-income mother who may be a mother of color, African-American mother, she may be more likely to be tested for substances at birth, where a middle-class family, particularly a white middle-class family, may have a substance abuse issue but not receive that testing. Other areas in distressed communities that some African-American families may be living in, things like poverty, substance abuse, domestic domestic violence. Again, these are issues that all communities contend with, but because of a number of factors related to how our society views families and individuals of color, many times those families get involved in the child welfare system versus being diverted into supportive resources, counseling, domestic violence treatment, etc.
What is it that you're hoping will happen as a result of this conference? What are you hoping to jumpstart here?
The whole topic of adoption really isn't receiving the attention that it did, say, 10, 20 years ago. So we want this conference to provide an opportunity for families, for individuals, professionals to come together to talk about ways to break down some of the barriers that might be preventing families from adopting. Also, just to be able to talk about the beauty of caring for children and what that looks like when a child is in foster care and is available for adoption. How does one maneuver through that process? So we'll have a panel of adoptive parents, adoptees, adoption professionals, as well as researchers. We have 5 breakout sessions on various topics related to both adoption and foster care. And so it's an opportunity, again, to fellowship, to gather information, to network, and really establish those relationships that are needed to break down barriers.
What would you say are the major barriers if you had to list 2, 3, 4 of them?
Sometimes misperceptions on both parts, misperceptions about African-American families, the perception that they are not likely to adopt at same rates as others. Again, that's a misperception because there's been informal adoptions going on for years. There's also sometimes misperceptions about resources available to families who seek to adopt. And sometimes just having some conversation with other professionals or other adoptive families can really help tip the scale. So those are some of the major misperceptions.
Is the conference mainly aimed at helping break down the barriers to African-American families to adoption, or should white families come who maybe would be interested in raising an African-American child?
Absolutely. You know, we really live in a multicultural society. One of our workshops specifically addresses multicultural families. So families who are adopting African-American children who may not be African-American themselves. Because again, children, whether they're adopted by an African-American family or a white family or a family of another race, those families need support, maybe different kinds of support. So we welcome all families, all community members, and people who generally care about children to attend this conference. It is free of charge. There's a banquet. We have our keynote speaker, who's Victoria Rowell. She's an actress who, she just has a long resume, but she was in Diagnosis Murder, as well as The Youngest and Restless. And she grew up in foster care. So she wrote a book called The Women Who Raised Me, and just really talks about her journey. And her mother had a history of mental illness and how she was able to overcome some of those early life challenges.
One of your goals, I'm assuming, and one of the things you'll be discussing at your conference is how to get more African-American families to adopt African-American children.
Absolutely. Because again, when we have the history of informal adoptions, sometimes there are agencies, quite frankly, still, even though services are offered and to every family, there are still perhaps some challenges that agencies face being able to adequately serve and recruit African-American families.
What is the hurdle? Why is it difficult to recruit African-American families to adopt this large pool of children who really need a home?
Many of the families that are caring for children in foster care currently are other relatives, extended family. And so one of the barriers is, say, if you have a grandmother or an aunt or an uncle who is raising their child, they may feel reluctant to actually take the step and adopt because that involves terminating the parental rights of the child who would be a family member, the biological family member. The other thing is for non-related adoptions, some of the barriers related to recruitment may be things like, do we really have the relationships established within African-American community so that there is a level of trust, so that there is communication, even things like what are the office hours of the agency? If the agency is open during 9 to 5 hours and families are working, do they have access to those services? There were years when I worked in adoption myself, and we saw that one of the barriers sometimes was a huge ream of paperwork that people receive. You're working every day, and you know your life is busy, and in order to adopt, you get a packet of 50 pages worth of material that you have to read. And so there are ways through interviewing and other avenues to break down some of those barriers to make it easier for families to adopt.
Is part of the issue that many African American families maybe just cannot afford to do an adoption?
Sure. Although, you know, in many ways there's misconceptions about that because particularly when we're talking about children who are in foster care needing homes, the majority of those children, because of past traumas, et cetera, that have gone on in their lives, families many times are eligible for adoption subsidies. So again, when those relationships are established within communities of color, so families have a better understanding of the resources that may be available, even things like support for college in some cases, ongoing support for medical care and things like that. There are subsidies available. Many times families just frankly aren't aware of those resources.
You obviously have a passion for this area. I'm wondering your own personal story.
Actually, I'm a member of the adoption community myself. I was raised, which started out as an informal caregiving situation. I was raised by my great aunt and uncle after my birth mother passed away when I was 2 years old. And my family did later adopt me. It was done privately, again, without the support of an agency. And, you know, my parents told me that they had tried to go through an adoption agency to adopt. And this was in the 60s. I'm dating myself. But they were told that because they didn't have two bathrooms in the house to adopt one child, they had a standard that there had to be two bathrooms in the house for a family to adopt. So again, what a barrier to a good family to have money to do construction on their home.
I hope we've progressed a little bit since then.
I hope so, too. Yes, we have.
Dr. Doris Houston is a professor of social work at Illinois State University. She's also the director of the Center for Child Welfare and Adoption Services. She will be involved in a conference called The Heart and Soul of Adoption about breaking down barriers to adoption. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Judy. I appreciate your time.
I'm Judy Valente.
The conference takes place tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the ISU Bone Student Center. The conference is free. The keynote speaker is actress Victoria Rowell, who starred in TV's Diagnosis Murder and will speak about her own experience in foster care. Find more information about the conference at our website, wglt.org. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from State Farm Bank, offering mortgage consultation and rates to help you move from renting to owning your home. Additional information available by calling 1-855-891-HOME. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS ID 139716. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. For four decades, lovers have loved, kings have gone mad and been murdered, and the bard has gone from iambic pentameter to rap on stage of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Laura Kennedy has more on the 40th anniversary season, soon to open this summer.
At the first ever Illinois Shakespeare Festival, back when it wasn't even called that, the plays were staged on the tennis courts at Ewing Manor in Bloomington. 40 years later, and the acclaimed festival has its own spiffy theater and a great reputation as a local cultural gem. Kevin Rich, artistic director for the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, says the festival has not only endured for 40 years, it's thrived and grown. And that success, Rich attributes to the support of the community and Illinois State University.
I'm just really proud that we're still standing. These days, you know, it's tough to run a theater company. I think it's really important, and I think all the artistic directors and managing directors in the history of the festival have known this, that it's not enough to say we're important, we have to be important. So if we are creating theater that impacts our community in meaningful ways, they'll keep us around.
Tell me, Kevin, what are you going to do this year to make the 40th anniversary special?
Yeah, we really did want to make it an extra special season. I'm just so excited about the plays that we have programmed. So we've got three. They're all comic. I just wanted it to be a joy bomb. I just wanted it to be a celebration of theater and imagination and laughter. And so all three of them, I think, are shaping up to be great fun. Even I Heart Juliet, which is, you know,
the ending's a bit of a downer, but
exactly, but it's an adaptation of a tragedy, and yet it's the Cue Brothers' take on it, so you can bet it's going to have a lot of laughs.
Well, let's talk about I Heart Juliet. You're directing.
I am.
Okay, and you brought back the Cue Brothers for this.
Yes.
They did the adaptation of Two Gentlemen of Verona, this wonderful hip hop adaptation of that.
That was in 2015. Q-Gents.
Yeah, that must have been really successful.
It was. You know, it was great. When we first announced it, we had some people go, hip-hop Shakespeare, huh? Well, I've never tried that, but I'll give it a shot. And then it just went like gangbusters. And afterwards, for the past 2 years, all I've heard are, you know, people saying, when are you going to bring those Cue Brothers back? Which is terrific. As you know, because we've talked about this many times, I'm really passionate about doing what Shakespeare was doing, right? It's important for Shakespeare Festival to do Shakespeare, obviously. But considering that Shakespeare was writing new plays that were adaptations of his classics, I think it's important that we do the same. We nurture our contemporary playwrights who are writing plays that can be described as Shakespearean. And the Cue Brothers are just such a perfect example of that. And it was my hope that by my fifth season, which is what this is, we would commission a new play. So we started that New Work Initiative way back then. And we have built to the point where we had such buy-in and such support from our board that several board members came forward and helped make it possible for us to commission this play. So we are the first audience looking at their latest adaptation.
Adaptation. Okay.
Yeah, that's what they call them.
Trademark that one.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they don't call their actors actors. They call them raptors, which I think is so great. So we're not acting, we're rapting.
So how did the Cue Brothers feel about having their work return here, particularly for the 40th season?
Q-Gents was commissioned by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, but they very generously let us take a first look at it. And it was great for them because they're based in Chicago. So we were close enough that they were able to come down, yeah, and develop this play. And it was a really positive experience in 2015. And they said, you know, hopefully we can make this happen again. And I Heart Juliet was... It was initially done in residency with Connecticut College years ago, but it's been sitting on their shelf, and this is the first professional commission of the play. And so, yeah, when I said we'd love to involve you in the 40th anniversary, this title came up immediately, and it's a great fit.
Now, originally, when they were here in 2015 to do Q-Gents, they were the performers. They were the only two performers,
yes,
which was quite amazing to watch. But this time, they have...
It's a larger
they're
cast.
They're raptors.
Yes. Yes,
they have
a cast of raptors.
They have a cast of raptors. I just keep picturing these dinosaurs on stage. I need to expunge that from my brain.
Yeah, but most of their work does involve more actors. That show, Q-Gents, is the only two-person show they have so far, to my knowledge. And they've just gotten big enough. They've got commissions from from very big theaters, and they were out in New York doing Othello the Remix off-Broadway. They were actually just out there. They were nominated for a Drama Desk for that. So I thought, you know, I knew it would be hard to get them back for an entire summer again. So they're playwrights on this one. And actually, there are four of them, the four actors who contributed to, who were actors in their four-person Othello the Remix. They're all playwrights. So they're the Q Brothers Collective. It's the two actual brothers and then two additional guys, Jackson Doran and Postel Pringle, who have worked on many of their projects with them, have also contributed to this script.
Are the performers accustomed to working with this type of material?
So it was a very interesting casting process, I'll tell you that, because we had some high demands this year. Our Midsummer Night's Dream is incredibly musical, so we needed great singers and musicians who could play instruments. But we also needed them to be able to rap and dance and then, of course, do Shakespeare. And I'm telling you, we found an amazing cast. We have just an incredibly talent. I'm just in awe of the talent of this ensemble. I say that every year, but I mean, they're really wonderful. And it, in some ways, it's different in the sense that, you know, it's rap and there are some contemporary dances, so you have to have some moves. On the other hand, it's heightened language. It's lyrical heightened language. And we have found that actors who have a facility for Shakespeare wind up having a facility for this form and vice versa. So we have some people in the cast who have more of a Shakespeare background. We also have some people who have worked on Q Brothers shows in the past. So it's great to have that variety in the room.
I'm sure the phenomenal success of Hamilton has really opened this up in the theater world for performers who have these kinds of chops.
Right. And as popular as that play is, I can imagine, you know, especially with younger audiences, a hip-hop version of Romeo and Juliet is going to be an incredibly popular title for high school theater and college theater.
Are you going to specifically market younger audiences with this show?
You know, it's funny. We don't have to do a whole lot of marketing anymore. We're already almost sold out.
No way!
Yeah. Now, we are doing it in our smaller space because 10 actors mic'd outside was just not really possible.
So you're going to be in Westhoff?
In the Westhoff Theater. It's an intimate staging of this show. And because of that, seating is limited relative to Ewing Theater. So we're getting pretty close to being sold out. We still have seats available. Yeah, there's been great demand for this show. There really were a lot of people who were excited to hear that we were bringing them back. I think there were also some people who missed QGents who want to see this, you know, who want to make sure that they don't miss this one.
So let's talk about A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Great.
This is something really fresh.
Yes, and it's directed and conceived by Robert Quinlan, who directed Richard II 2 years ago and Macbeth 4 years ago, and he runs the MFA directing program here. He's one of my favorite directors in the country, and I'm so glad that he's working on this play. It's his favorite play, and he's worked on Midsummer on a number of occasions, so he knows this play as well as anyone I know.
Did he compose the music for it as well?
Well, his actor playing Puck, Jordan Cawftry, is an unbelievable musician and composer, and he composed the music for this production. We've got an entire cast of musician singers, so he's taking advantage of that, and so it'll be a very musical production of Midsummer, and Jordan has done amazing things with Shakespeare's lyrics.
He's basically taking the text and setting it to music.
That's right.
You're also doing Cymbeline, and you only have six actors in Cymbeline.
Yes.
So tell me about this show.
Well, again, we were really thinking about having a magical 40th. And magic is a theme that shows up in all three plays, in Romeo and Juliet, obviously, with a potion, and Midsummer. Cymbeline is also a very magical play. The other way to use that word magic is to think about theater magic. And when you have six amazing actors telling a huge story, and it's got this real fairy tale quality anyway, it's pretty wonderful, and every Equity actor in the cast is in that six-person ensemble, so it's really strong work.
Let's hear about the actors. Who's portraying the characters?
Nissy Sturgis, who was here playing Lady Macbeth in 2013, and you may have seen her on HBO's Boardwalk Empire.
Yes.
She is back to play Imogen. Festival favorite Tom Quinn is back for, I think, his 13th season to play the title role of Cymbeline. And, of course, I say that, but then there's a number of other roles he plays, too, because you've got six guys playing all the
But that's his main character.
Yep. And then Jordan Cawftry, who plays Puck, you know, it's a rep company, so everyone's in multiple plays. He's playing Posthumus and Cloten. It's very interesting to think about that doubling. There's really brilliant doubling and tripling in these plays that I think actually fits the story very well. And in this adaptation, there's a sort of a piano-playing narrator who helps us. He also jumps into the action of the play as a variety of characters, but he sort of comes out with it's the sense that he's opening a giant book and telling us a story. And that really is how I think this play, but all of Shakespeare's late plays, feel. There's that sort of fairy tale storybook sensibility to them, and a six-person adaptation lends itself to this idea that, you know, actors in a trunk of costumes, and we're telling a story. You know, I read that script and I thought of Andy Park immediately.
Andy Park, so, director Andy Park.
Yes, he directed Failure, a Love Story in 2013, and then last year directed
Peter and the Starcatcher,
which is another, you know, it's story theater. This is just right in his wheelhouse. And he read the script and said, I know exactly what to do with this. And he's sort of taking a vaudevillian circus take on it, that these are almost circus performers telling us these stories.
In addition, this season, you're also bringing back the improv show, the Improvised Shakespeare Show, right?
Yep. They've been here every year I've been here. Their first year was in 2013, and we brought them back by popular demand every year since. And there's been enough demand for them that we're actually giving them a main stage slot this year. So historically, they've always been in a 6 p.m. pre-show spot. But because our I Heart Juliet is indoors, that'll play in Westhoff on Tuesday night, and at the same time, Improvised Shakespeare will play in a 7:30 slot out at Ewing.
What about your theater for young audiences? What do you have planned for this year?
Two of them.
Oh, two of them.
That's another one that has just grown and grown. We've seen our audiences grow every year for that show, so that we have our usual offering is on Wednesday and Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. That'll be Sleeping Beauty this year, a really wonderful adaptation of Sleeping Beauty performed by our wonderful and incredibly talented intern company. And then we have a second TYA offering that will be a pre-show. It's a three-woman comedy of errors that will play every night we do Cymbeline. So at, I think, 6:30 every night, we have Cymbeline playing at Ewing. You can come early and see this three-woman comedy of errors on the lawn of Ewing Manor.
It's always interesting to watch the trends in Shakespeare. I mean, for a long, long time, basically, people would do Shakespeare with the collars and with the ruffs and the codpiece and all that kind of thing. And then it became very popular to take it out of its time and put it in a different time period.
Like the Wild West or something.
Yeah, yeah. Like into a road warrior version.
Yes.
And then we started seeing the original practices where,
yes,
the men would play the women's roles. And
yes,
now we're seeing hip-hop coming into Shakespeare.
Yes.
So there's all kinds of interesting trends going on with Shakespeare. Where do these trends originate? Do they come out of the Shakespeare festivals? Do they come out of the coasts? Where do they come from?
Oh, this is such a good question. And one that I'm really interested in investigating. My thought is, because it does seem to be happening everywhere, and there are ways that Shakespeare festivals communicate with each other. There's the Shakespeare Theater Association. It's a conference every year where people get together and brainstorm ideas. But I think all of it is attempting to make Shakespeare accessible, right? I mean, that's that word accessible to a contemporary audience, I think, is always operating for these theater practitioners who are staging Shakespeare. And I think this trend towards reviving this sense of gender bending, I mean, considering how Shakespeare designed the plays to be performed originally with audience interaction and doubling of roles, and sort of realizing you don't necessarily need to set it in a modern location, you just need to engage with your audience in the way that Shakespeare intended his plays to be performed. And so I like that we're kind of moving in this direction. And the thought about, you know, I have some people say hip-hop is not Shakespeare, but when you think that Shakespeare was adapting his classics, was updating classical stories that his audience was already familiar with and adding contemporary music and contemporary references and contemporary poetry, then these sort of hip-hop versions of Shakespeare's plays are very much in the spirit of what Shakespeare was doing.
Kevin Rich spoke with GLT's Laura Kennedy. While this is the festival's 40th season, it's Kevin Rich's last as artistic director. He's moved on to the University of Colorado at Boulder. The Illinois Shakespeare Festival season begins June 28th. The new season for the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts was scheduled with a new mandate, fewer shows that have only a niche audience and more shows with a wider appeal. In other words, shows that will as they say in showbiz, put more butts in seats. WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talked with the City of Bloomington Assistant Performing Arts Director Anne-Marie Dittman about the lineup for the 2017-2018 season. Dittman says there's something for everyone and every age, including this a cappella group, Gobsmacked.
Hey, yeah, 'cause you make me feel like I've been locked out of heaven for too long.
I think it's very important to be aware of the variety of tastes within the community. I like to reflect the diversity and the spirit of our community. I think it's very important to have something that children and families can attend together, something that older people would like to see, our active adults, and something that 20-somethings would want to see.
Comedian Brian Regan would probably fall into that category. He's known as the clean comic and has been featured on Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
Some people get really upset if you get their name wrong, especially if they have a name that's similar to another name. Carolyn and Caroline. They got a thing about that, man. Don't get that wrong, because they're going to drill you. Hi, Carolyn. It's Caroline. It's Caroline, Brian. It's Brian. Yes, my name is Brian. Very hard to say my name correctly.
I know that you always shoot for a couple of big shows that might have wide appeal, and hopefully you do so well with those that can maybe offset a show that might not be quite as popular, but that does appeal to a niche audience that you do want to try to serve.
Right, and we definitely have that. Kinky Boots is definitely a show that's going to have wide appeal. Also Gobsmacked, which is an a cappella musical, more of a cabaret type show, but it's a cappella. I think that will have a big audience here.
You're crazy and I'm out of my mind, 'cause all of me loves all of you. Love your curves and all your edges. All your perfect
produced Shakespeare is another theater program that I think has very wide appeal. There are jokes that will go over the heads of kids and adults will get. And yeah, there's a lot of physical humor that kids will enjoy. So that show, the Reduced Shakespeare Company's show, William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, is on its way to Broadway soon after it plays here. So rather than being a Tony Award-winning show like Kinky Boots that's coming here, we get to see it before it hits Broadway.
Yeah, you see, basically Shakespeare was a formula writer. Once he found a device that worked, he used it over and over and over again. So Mr. Shakespeare, the question we have is this. Why did you write 16 comedies when you could have written just one?
Well, in answer to this question, we of the Reduced Shakespeare Company have taken the liberty of condensing all 16 of Shakespeare's comedies into a single play, which we have entitled The Comedy of Two Well-Measured Gentlemen Lost in the Merry Wives of Venice on a Midsummer's Twelfth Night in Winter.
Or Cymbeline Taming Pericles the Merchant in the Tempest of Love As Much as You Like It for Nothing. Or Four Weddings and a Transvestite.
I've enjoyed Reduced Shakespeare Company's work for over 20 years. And when I heard that they had a new show that they were touring, I was, of course, interested in seeing if we could fit that into our season. It had been something that Tina had a little scribbled note about. And so when I talked to the agent and was able to get it, I thought that was a great thing for our audiences to be able to see what they were touring right before they took it to Broadway.
That hasn't happened that often, has it?
In this region, it doesn't happen that often. I think it's really exciting for Central Illinois to be able to have a show that they will see before the Broadway audience gets it.
And getting a show like Kinky Boots, is that going to be the show that you fill the most seats and could possibly sell out?
I think there's a very good chance that will sell out. Of course, we always hope that all of our shows will do well. And that we actually did book this season with the idea in mind that we would like to try to increase audiences for the shows. So we are doing fewer shows that have a smaller niche audience and more shows that we think will have a broader appeal, which is not to say that there isn't something for everyone, but we were very much looking at the bottom line as we were booking shows for the season.
Some of those crowd favorites will include an outdoor concert next month, the Cornerstones of Rock, featuring bands such as the Buckinghams and the Ides of March, that will appeal to baby boomers. And the Neverly Brothers will be back at the BCPA for return engagement in January, singing hits from Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly, and the Beatles.
From a tree, dressed up and they called it me. Everybody's trying to be my baby. Everybody's trying to be my baby. Everybody's trying to be my baby now.
And there are some shows that we did have to let go because we just didn't think that we would get the response that would make it fiscally responsible to book the show.
Can you give us an example?
A show that I know Tina really, really loved and would be a lot of fun to have here is Squonk. It is an outside show only. It is a very big production, and we have traditionally only charged $15, not more than $20 for outside shows. So unless we wanted to dramatically increase the ticket price for an outside show, it didn't seem like a good fit for this particular season. I'd love to be able to bring it another time, but we really were looking at the bottom line of a lot of shows this year, trying to be responsible.
Was that based on any directive or the deficit, or what was driving that?
You always want your Performing Arts Center to perform well financially, but yes, we had a directive from the city manager that we should try to reduce losses or build revenues, and that we were to plan the season with that as one of the factors that we were considering. Certainly not necessarily the one overriding factor, but it was to be a major consideration in booking the season.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Colleen Reynolds, and we're talking with Assistant Performing Arts Manager for the City of Bloomington, Anne-Marie Dittman, about the new season. And I would suppose that your other big headliner is George Thorogood and the Destroyers. And it's coming at a particularly interesting time for him. He's 69 years old, but I recently read he is releasing a solo album, the first solo album of his entire career. But he is going to be performing with the Destroyers, right?
Yes, he will definitely be performing with the Destroyers, and the pending release of his solo album is very exciting. And just seeing the clips that the marketing department has given us for that concert, I can hardly wait to see it. He has so much energy, and he will be doing mostly his former repertoire of songs. And yeah, it would be a rocking good time, definitely.
Out of the ball. I drink alone. Yeah. I want one bourbon, one scotch, one beer, one bourbon.
For that concert, $1 for each of the tickets is being donated to the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society at his request. So that is part of this tour as well.
Do you know his connection to that cause?
I really don't, but it's the first time that I've encountered that stipulation in booking a show and ticketing a show. And you know, it's wonderful that he can put his celebrity and his energy behind helping to raise funds for a good cause.
The other thing I noticed about this lineup versus last year's lineup. Last year's lineup, you had three kind of country related, one more strongly than the other, but there was a definite emphasis, I think, on country, which does have a loyal fan base and so forth, but I don't really see country represented here yet. Do you think that's yet to come?
I definitely think that's yet to come, and that was something I was very specifically looking for. None of the routing for any of the shows that we wanted was really working out yet for this season. But music shows in particular are things that tend to book really close to when they will appear. And we will definitely be having additional shows added during the season. I would definitely say that we will have at least one fairly major country show coming.
What will be the most expensive ticket of the season and maybe the least expensive ticket?
The least expensive tickets are usually our movies. And we will continue to do the silent films with organ music by Dennis Scott. Those are very popular. popular in terms of live performance tickets. I would say that Journey to Oz, which is a family show, is a lower priced ticket. Push's Dracula is another sort of middling to lower priced ticket.
And this summer you are not doing Beer Fest.
Beer Fest was great fun, but there are so many beer fests in this area that we didn't feel we were really, for the amount of time and effort that it took for our staff to produce that, we really didn't think we were getting a good return. So it was largely an economic choice not to do that again. Of course, we still wanted fun entertainment out on the lawn in the summer. So we're doing the Summer Solstice Concert. We will have beer vans. We will have lots of craft beer, both on draft and in bottles and cans. We will have nonstop music from noon to 10 p.m. So the main stage will be more bigger bands, rock and roll kind of stuff. And the second stage, which will be playing half-hour sets during the changeover on the main stage, is all acoustic.
Mama said nothing good ever happens after midnight. Mama said nothing good ever happens after midnight. I don't feel like being good tonight. No, I don't feel like being good.
All local bands, it'll be great fun. And we'll have food trucks here as well. We'll have Oogie's, Healthy in a Hurry, and the Dinner Bell here for Summer Solstice. And we'll have those and maybe another one during the Cornerstones of Rock in July.
Well, Anne-Marie, we're going to wrap it up here, but I wanted to ask, tickets go on sale officially?
So officially, tickets are on sale to the public on June 22nd. In the meantime, arts partners who are donors to the theater are allowed to buy tickets in advance. If you're not an arts partner, but you see something that is particularly interesting to you and you'd like to buy tickets in advance, any arts partner at the $100 level or up can get early ticket purchasing privileges. So if you'd like to become an arts partner, you can get those tickets now.
Anne-Marie Dittman, thanks so much for joining us on Sound Ideas today.
GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talking with the Bloomington Assistant Performing Arts Director, Anne-Marie Dittman. The Summer Solstice Concert is from noon to 10 p.m. this Saturday on the front lawn of the BCPA, and tickets are $15 for all ages at the gate. The entire season lineup is available on the events page of artsblooming.org. You're listening to George Thorogood and the Destroyers, part of the 2017-2018 season at the BCPA.
I come home one Friday, had to tell the landlady I done lost my job. She said, that don't confront me, long as I get my money next Friday. Now next Friday I come, I didn't get the rent, and out the door I went.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Populations of bees and other important pollinators are declining worldwide. But right in your own backyard, you can create a haven for those helpful little guys. Patrick Murphy has a plan on this edition of GLT's Grow.
Pollinators need our help to thrive, and you can do your part by creating a pollinator habitat. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It is Patrick Murphy. Hi, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, calling all pollinators to your yard. So let's get some great plants in the ground that'll bring those pollinators in.
And this is beautiful and important all at the same time. Grow does not do any kind of testing or knowledge check at the end of our broadcast, but this is important, so please pay attention.
Okay, let's take some notes. Number
pollinators,
two,
they're like critical. They're essential for life as we know it, basically. Pollinators include bees and butterflies, moths, hummingbird, beetles, wasps, flies, and others. The honeybee, inside that whole list of characters, the honeybee is a stressed species, but they are a keystone species. They benefit all the other living animals, you know. So the bee is pollinating bushes that the grizzly bear and the groundhog and the other, and us, you know. It's pollinating food that's part of everything's mm-hmm. cycle, so that they're very important.
Okay, well, let's get some plants out there for them.
So, you know, pollinator plants a lot of times are designed to attract or used to attract butterflies and hummingbirds because they're so wonderful to watch, but it's the bees that are important.
Right.
And when it comes to annual flowers here in the Midwest, you have a huge list to choose from. So you got everything from low to the ground to the great big tall stuff. Calandula, sweet alyssum, the poppy, sunflowers, zinnia, heliotrope. Bees are just going to go crazy on these. And here's something else that'll help you in your gardening endeavors so you can make your pollinator garden fabulous. Plant them in colonies. Don't mix them up like confetti. Mm-hmm. They don't grow that way typically in the wild. Yeah, there's some mixture on the fringes, but the bees can do more effective foraging when you plant it all in a big smorgasbord type colony.
Okay.
All right. And that looks better too. It's the Disney effect, as I've called it before. The flowers look great in mass, and that helps the bees find them and to do their foraging more efficiently.
Okay.
For the perennials, for the permanent parts of your landscape, where you can combine this with woody plants and trees and just totally layer your landscape with pollinator-friendly plants. We've all seen crocus, buttercup, aster, anemone, snowdrops, geranium. We love these in the landscape already. Again, let's plant them out where the pollinators can have access to them.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of plants that we can list, like the herbs, if you're a culinary person. Lavender, catmint, sage, fennel, thyme.
Oh, good thyme.
That's right. They all work, and there's even trees that are friendly to pollinators. Like in the Midwest, we get the tulip tree, Laura, you know, the great big monster tulip tree with the green and orange flowers.
Yes.
Well, not only do they attract pollinators, but they can become part of the architecture in your garden on your property because the tree can be used in combination with walls of a structure to create an implied wall. Because the butterflies and the bees and the pollinators, they do best when there's a tranquil air, when the air is still. So a blustery day is hard working for them.
Yeah, it's trying to fly against the wind. Nah.
And you can, like if you planted a tulip tree, say 25 feet or further away from your house, it's probably going to always be in the safe zone. And it's going the space between the tree and the house, there's a calmness created in that little area.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that, so if you already have some trees at your property, you may already have a great front stage spot for this pollinator garden. But I wanted to take the time to say, yeah, we can talk about all the plant lists. The National Forest Service has one for whatever area you are in. So that's the easy part. You got to create an environment that the pollinators like to visit.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, creating a gorgeous pollinator habitat. So make it, put in the right plants and make a nice, tranquil location for them. And don't use poisons.
That's right. If you're interested in having a pollinator garden, there should not only be zero pesticides, but you should not have oceans of heavy mulch because you just need a thin layer because a lot of these pollinators live in the earth.
Oh, really?
In your garden. So they don't like the 4 inches of mulch. They like maybe an inch and a half or two.
That's very important. That's a good distinction there.
And they like a little bit of a mess. So they like some leaves on the ground and stuff like that. And another thing that they hate that'll take you out of the game completely for a lot of pollinator insects is the underlayment.
Well, I'm sorry, what?
Fabric or plastic that's placed under rock or mulch.
Gotcha. So if you're trying to keep out weeds, you might also be keeping out pollinators.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That's right. I mentioned using trees and other woody plants in conjunction with features on your property to create little sheltered areas where you have still air, maybe some shade, and maybe even a spot where you could have a bird bath that was close to the ground because butterflies puddle. They do this little socializing thing, and they get on the ground, and they oftentimes do it in a spot where there's moisture. Yeah. Who would have thought?
No, I had no idea they needed water, too, like that.
Yeah, and, so it's hard to tell people to get out there and do a good job gardening, but keep it kind of messy, but that's what you got to do, because a lot of the pollinators, they live where they eat, and you get the best effects from those. For the honeybees, the colors that attract them the most are purple and yellow.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. It seems like high school colors or something.
Yeah, yeah. Hummingbirds, you got the trumpet-shaped flowers, you know, like a foxglove or a petunia.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is red is a good color for the hummingbirds.
Yeah.
But, you know, moths fly around a lot, and I think people might mistake them sometimes for hummingbirds because they can be so large.
Oh, yeah.
But they do a great deal of pollinating, and they do so at night. You know, so they might be attracted to some of those flowers that are lighter in color.
Oh, what about like an evening primrose? Would that help?
How could it hurt?
Absolutely.
How could it hurt? There's always room for an evening primrose, for heaven's sake.
I'm a big fan, to be quite honest with you.
And it's important to mention, too, that the habitat for our pollinators, and most importantly, the keystone bee, its habitat is shrinking, and it's shrinking from, in part, sprawl.
Yes.
You know, we get growing up and outward. But also from pesticide abuse.
Yeah.
Not pesticide, you know, use in general, because if you do what the manufacturer says, you can stay out of trouble.
Okay.
But it's the abuse of pesticides and the overspraying, over-applications and things like that. Colonizing, like I mentioned, also increases the fragrancing potential for your enjoyment, but that's another way that pollinators are attracted to your garden.
Because it smells good.
It's got to smell good.
Yeah.
I didn't see one piece of information about having the rancorous area, you know. So how do you compost if you have the pollinator garden remotely? So you don't want it right there. You know, it's not the same thing. Just because we say have it messy, that doesn't mean you can compost on the ground right there. They're two separate things.
Yeah. What you need is a nice perfumed garden, a nice tranquil area. And no abuse of the poisons, and they should come running.
You should have a good, clean habitat that's great for your enjoyment and also for our pollinators.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much, Murph. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, we're taking a question from Michael in Bloomington who wants to know about getting rid of spider mites. So we're going to be tackling that next on GLT's Grow next week. If you've got a gardening question that you'd like Murph to take on, go to our website, WGLT.org. Fill in the form and send that along to us. We would love to hear from you. Maybe Murph will answer your question on the air. Send those questions at WGLT.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast
Funding
weekly
for here and
at
now.
iTunes and at WGLT.org. That's also where you can find the Sound Ideas podcast, along with interviews today from Colleen Reynolds, Laura Kennedy, and Judy Valente. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLTFM.
GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com.